This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As the United States moves towards war with Iraq, Europe, especially France and Germany, proclaim more and more loudly, no. It is not an exaggeration to say that relations between the United States and Europe may be the worst they've been in nearly half a century. What happened? Well, how did some of America's closest allies become its biggest critics? Robert Kagan has some answers, and he's put them in a new book. One I should mention is pleasantly small and very readable, called Of Paradise and Power, America and Europe in the New World Order. Robert Kagan has an interesting perspective because he actually lives in Europe, in Brussels, in fact, which is sometimes called the capital of Europe. He is a senior associate for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and spends much of his time thinking and writing about the U.S. role in the world as director of the endowment's U.S. Leadership Project. How important is the relationship between the United States and Europe? Do Europe and the United States approach power differently? And what's the basis of the difference? Philosophy? Culture? Ideology? And is a transatlantic rivalry healthy or hurtful? If you'd like to get in on the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Robert Kagan joins us now from our bureau in New York, and thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Neil.
I've said the book is short. You don't waste a lot of time getting into it. I'm going to read the first line of your book. It is time to stop pretending, you write, that Europeans and Americans share a common view of the world or even that they occupy the same world. This is an enormous difference.
Well, yes, it is, and it's something that became apparent to me precisely because I was living in Europe, and I must say I went to a lot of transatlantic conferences where Americans and Europeans discussed foreign policy issues, and the opening premise of all these conferences was, of course, we agree on the basic fundamental questions. It's only the details that we disagree about, and I must say over a course of some time it became clear to me that wasn't true, and that really we disagree about fundamentals, and that Europeans have really developed a very different view of military power, the legitimacy of power, international institutions, and international legal system than Americans, and that has really, it goes back before 9/11, it goes back even into the 1990s.
You write that in a way, Europe today, and by Europe you're speaking of the European community, that group of nations, that in a way they live in a post-historical world. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that what Europe has created in the European Union over the past 10 years is really something of a geopolitical miracle. The European powers who fought two horrendous wars in the 20th century and many wars before that have created a system that really has no use for military power. When European countries deal with one another, they deal with one another through diplomatic means, through international legal mechanisms. The European Union is a kind of post-historical state, much as Immanuel Kant once envisioned. It's a kind of condition of perpetual peace, and it's really a wonderful thing for Europeans, and I think Americans should appreciate that it's good for Americans, too, that Europe doesn't really seem threatened by the prospect of a war breaking out anytime soon.
Yet the United States, you write, remains mired in history and in a Hobbesian world. What do you mean by that?
Well, the United States still lives in a world, we're obviously not part of this European international system. We are part of a larger international system where there are still aggressors like Saddam Hussein, still dangerous people like Kim Jong-il, still countries that believe in old-fashioned power politics and who need to be deterred with old-fashioned military force. And so in that sense, America doesn't live in that kind of paradise that Europe has been created. In fact, America sort of stands guard around the walls of that European paradise. And I think sometimes Europeans don't quite appreciate the degree to which the reason they can enjoy the peace that they enjoy in Europe is due to the power that the United States has used over 50 years and more.
And it is precisely that word, power, and the use of power, on which these two, taking Europe as a broad subject and America as a broad subject, on which they most fundamentally disagree?
Increasingly, yes. Europe, because of what they've been able to create on their own continent, has now come to view military power as essentially illegitimate. They believe there are other answers to all world problems, By the way, so do many Americans. But in Europe, this is a monolithic view that if you look at a problem like Iraq or North Korea, there have got to be other ways of dealing with this besides military power. Whereas in the United States, I would say a majority of Americans, and especially after September 11, 2001, still believe that military power is an essential adjunct to diplomacy. Europeans, I think, believe diplomacy can replace military power. Americans think they have to go together.
In a way, that process can replace military power, that you can engage institutions and countries in discussions of how to go about things, and situations like dealing with Saddam Hussein is no different than essentially dealing with farm subsidies.
Well, that's certainly true, but the analogy that the Europeans specifically point to is dealing with Germany. I mean, after all, there was no regime that was uglier than the Nazi regime. A war defeated that regime, and then Germany was brought into Europe, and through careful compromise and beginning with economic links and moving on to political links, and in a way, the sort of bringing Germany into Europe in a safe way has been one of the great geopolitical accomplishments of mankind. And the Europeans are very proud of it, and now they believe they can take those methods and they ought to be applicable everywhere, including with someone like Saddam Hussein.
And a very important reason that you think Europe and the United States view the power and the use of power very differently is because the United States has it and Europe increasingly does not.
Well, I think that's true, and I really think that no one is particularly to blame for this. It's normal human psychology, it seems to me, that if one has a great deal of power, one is more inclined to use power to solve problems and also to believe in the legitimacy of using power to solve problems. After all, when the Europeans themselves were great powers earlier in the 20th century and then in the many centuries before that, they were great believers in the use of power. Now that the Europeans really have very little power, they are, not surprisingly, a little bit more skeptical about the use of power and even doubt its legitimacy. Ironically, again, the United States, when it was a very young country imperiled by the great European powers, the founding generation always used to talk about how we have to move beyond power politics and have a world dominated by international legal mechanisms. And now, 200 years later, when the United States is the most powerful country in the world, again, not surprisingly, Americans believe that there is, after all, some legitimacy to the use of military power.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Robert Kagan, the author most recently of Paradise and Power, America and Europe in the New World Order. And let's begin by going to Bennett, who's with us from San Antonio, Texas.
Yes, I couldn't agree more with what your guest is saying. And I think he's omitting one fact, if I may, in that we fought World War II against the Europeans, not as allies. And the whole idea of the European Economic Community as it started was to buck what they believed was American hegemony in Europe, and the Europeans are acting toward the United States, and my comparison would be like the Lilliputians to a Gulliver, and that their diplomats have been trying to undermine the United States, to make our policies very difficult to establish. Our economic initiatives are being thwarted by European diplomats. I mean, we're almost in a state of war with Europe.
Well, far be it from me to say that it's not as bad as all that, but I don't think it's as bad as all that. I mean, we do have this fundamental disagreement about power. I don't think we have a fundamental disagreement about economic issues. We both, in fact, spend all our time criticizing each other for not living up to the free trade ideals that we both share. So, and I emphasize in my book, and I would continue to emphasize, that let's not lose sight of the very, very broad common values that Europeans and Americans do share. And I think the strength of those ties prevent us from having a real sort of clash of civilizations within the West, as you will. Thinking about World War II, We didn't go to war with all of Europe. We went to war with Germany, with some very, you know, in behalf of France that had been defeated, in behalf of the United Kingdom
and
other
Italy
European countries.
And
Italy, too. But all of Europe, and I think we need to remember this, looked to the United States after World War II to help them put Europe back together again. They looked to the United States to provide the security which could allow France to start working together again with Germany. The Germans welcomed American power in Europe so that the other countries wouldn't be scared of them again. And most Europeans acknowledge, even today, the central role that the United States played in making possible this paradise that Europeans have since created.
Well, why should they object to a handout?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. I don't think it was a handout. I think it was very much in our interest to rebuild this Europe, first and foremost against the Soviet Union, but also a peaceful Europe is very, very much in America's interest. And we don't want to have to go to war again in Europe a third time.
Bennett, I think we're going to move on to another caller. Thanks very much for the questions. Let's try to go to Joe, who's with us from Londonderry, New Hampshire.
Hi. This is a great topic. There's so much there. I really agree with your guest. But I actually, in listening to the debate coming from, especially from France and Germany regarding Iraq, I'm kind of resentful of it because, you know, the United States is going to have to bear the burden of going after Saddam Hussein in terms of the military cost and the economic cost. You know, President Bush says he's ready to go in with or without the support of a lot of the European leaders. And, you know, at the same time, they stand to gain from a democratic Iraq that's not threatening world oil supplies because they'll have a lot of lucrative business deals there. So, in a sense, they're getting all the benefits of a military campaign against Saddam Hussein, but they don't have to pay any of the price. And I think it's always the Americans who are carrying this burden, and it's quickly forgotten in the European public. I mean, if you look at even European problems like the breakup of Yugoslavia and Kosovo, it was the United States, again, who was intervening in a European problem, and it didn't seem like European leaders, maybe with the exception of Britain, really lifted a finger to solve that kind of crisis situation either.
Robert Kagan, you use Kosovo as an example of the lack of European power, their inability to bring forces to bear even on their own continent.
Well, it's a big problem for the Europeans. In Kosovo, which was in most respects a successful war, as I mentioned in the book, it left a lot of ill feeling afterwards because, as you say, the United States carried 90% to 95% of the military load and therefore wound up controlling, in essence, the way the war was fought, the terms on which the war would be settled. And so while Europeans were happy to work with the United States, they're glad the United States came to help them deal with this problem in Europe, they also left feeling that, well, we really, you know, the United States is going to be calling all the shots from now on. And there was a brief moment when Europe thought, well, let's get our own military act together. And there was a lot of movement, and Tony Blair was critical in this, in working with Chirac and trying to build up a European military force that could give Europe a little bit more heft in these situations. The stunning thing to me is that that really hasn't gone anywhere. And even European leaders can't convince the European public that it's worth spending the extra 1% of their GDP on defense, if only so that the United States isn't the only power in the world calling all the shots. So the Europeans have got themselves in a bind. They're worried about American power, but they really aren't willing to do what's necessary to give themselves enough power to act on even a remotely equal plane.
Joe, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're talking with Robert Kagan about tensions in the Atlantic Alliance. When we come back from a break, we'll be taking more of your calls, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And you can send us questions by email as well. Our address is totn@npr.org. More after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the United States' relationship with its European allies. Our guest is Robert Kagan, the author of Paradise and Power, America and Europe in the New World Order. He's also director of the U.S. Leadership Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's at our bureau in New York. You're invited to join our discussion. The phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And here's an email question we get from Picard. I think people in Europe, he writes, view the Bush administration with detestation due to their lack of credibility that they gained from the 2000 elections, the unilateral policies, the strike first, ask questions later foreign policy, and the general overall arrogance of the Bush administration.
Well, that's a very accurate representation of what most Europeans that I run into think, and I could add a list that's even longer than that. Even before Bush was elected, and in that complicated election, they were already talking about the death penalty. It was a very big issue. One would go to foreign policy conferences to discuss what I usually think of as foreign policy early on in the Bush administration, and the first issue that would be raised was the death penalty. And we Americans would say, well, that's all well and good, but that's not really foreign policy. But to Europeans, they already started talking about a culture gap, and they think, many of them think of the United States as having what they call a culture of death, where everybody has a gun, and everybody's being killed under capital punishment laws. So there's a lot of the dimensions of this complicated relationship really are very broad and deep.
Do you see this as in part a difference in culture? For example, very interesting public opinion surveys recently conducted by Pew, among others. One of the things that they showed was, for example, the huge disparity in how religious these two places are.
Well, you know, and Europeans have been making a great deal of that. In fact, the European Union Foreign Minister Javier Solana was recently quoted as saying the big difference between America and particularly George Bush and Europeans was precisely that Americans are great believers. I was then in Spain, where a lot of Spaniards came up to me and said, that's not true. We in Spain are great believers, too, and Italians are great believers, and Poles are great believers. I mean, I think it's an overstatement to say that Europe has gone completely secular and atheist while America is completely religious. I think that's really beside the point. I think my argument that it's a different view of how the international system should work that really divides the two of us, not, I would say, religious issues.
Yet those very countries you mentioned, Poland, Spain, Italy, they're all members of the so-called Gang of Eight that just signed the editorial in the Wall Street, that letter in the Wall Street Journal supporting the United States.
That's true. Although I must say, I think the Catholic connection is coincidental. But no, partly that's because you have in both those countries two relatively conservative leaders in Aznar and Berlusconi, both of whom actually have good relationships with George Bush and have been willing to get way out in front of their publics on this issue. And the Eastern and Central Europeans are a very different lot. And here's where I can get into trouble trying to generalize about Europe, because Eastern and Central Europeans have had a very different historical experience. They were under the thumb of the Soviet Empire for many years. They are still worried about Russia. And so for them, the kind of military, the legitimacy of military power is still meaningful for them. And they joined the NATO alliance in order to come under the American security umbrella. So it's not really surprising, although it's certainly heartening, to see them lining up with the Bush administration on the Iraq question.
And after that, interesting to see a quote from a German politician saying, here we begin to see the flight of the vassals.
Well, the French and the Germans, but especially the French, were all along have been very nervous about taking these Eastern and Central European countries into the European Union, precisely because they feared that they would be an American fifth column. And I heard a lot of French foreign policy analysts sort of mumbling after the, as you call it, the Gang of Eight put out its letter, that we knew these Eastern and Central Europeans would line up with the Americans against us, and now they're in a bit of a... They're a little bit horrified because these countries are now coming into the European Union, and there's nothing France can do about it.
Let's go next to Rob, who joins us from Orange County, California.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make the comment, or a couple of comments, actually. I believe pretty strongly, or feel pretty strongly, that your guest's comparison of Saddam Hussein to Adolf Hitler is just historically irresponsible. I mean, I believe that Saddam Hussein is a distasteful character, and we should do what we can to encourage a regime change in Iraq, but comparing him to Hitler, I think, is a pretty wild exaggeration when you think that we, even Americans, didn't get involved in World War II until after, I mean, Hitler had invaded and conquered and occupied a half a dozen countries, and we didn't get involved until Pearl Harbor was attacked, so there's that comment. But I would also like to say that using the term power, your guest seems to be using that term interchangeably with military power as opposed to economic power, other forms of geopolitical power, and I just don't agree with that. I mean, I think that in Europe they have a 2 or 3 centuries more experience with a country that gains some military advantage like France or Germany and decides to throw its weight around, and I think that they may be ahead of us in the field of trying to solve geopolitical problems without just invading first and asking questions later.
Robert Kagan?
Well, that certainly is the European view, that they are ahead of us. And in fact, they often, the person I quote in my book, a fellow named Robert Cooper, who is a very brilliant British diplomat, refers to a postmodern world and what he calls the modern world, and then there's the pre-modern world. The postmodern world is Europe, because they have advanced into this new era of coping with international relations the way they do, and he sees the United States as still existing in what he calls the modern era, in the sense that the United States is still using military force as a tool of foreign policy. I wish it were true, personally, that all problems could be solved without military force. But I think a lot of the promise that people felt after the end of the Cold War, that we would be moving into an era of geoeconomics, not geopolitics, and that having a strong economy would be all that one needed, and that problems could be solved through the processes of globalization, etc. I think really we've discovered that that's not as true as we might have hoped. And Europeans have discovered, much to their own frustration, that despite the fact that Europe has a $9 trillion economy, as big as the United States, nevertheless, they are not able to exercise the influence with their economic strength that the United States is able to exercise with having both economic and military strength. And this is just, unfortunately, still the reality of the world, I think.
Bob, thanks very much.
Thank you.
There was an interesting column on Sunday, Tom Friedman in the New York Times, in which, among other things, he gave your book a nice plug. But one of the things that he wrote about was the frustration of how difficult it is for once great powers to no longer be so great.
Well, I think that Tom is really onto something there, that there's an element of adjusting that the Europeans have been going through for some time now, but which is really confronting them in the last few years. I mean, after all, France, Britain, Spain, Italy, Germany, these were all grand empires. These people ruled the world for hundreds of years. Now, they destroyed it. They destroyed their imperial rule themselves, I mean, by going to war twice in the 20th century. And then, really, all that was left standing was the United States and the Soviet Union. And now the Cold War has ended, and all that's left standing is the United States. And I think, I don't think it's an insult to the French. I think most Europeans agree that the French, in particular, have this very strong desire to still be recognized as a serious international power, which is one reason you see them trying to exercise so much influence at the on the UN Security Council, because their seat on the UN Security Council gives them far more power than their relative strength on the international scene would give them. And so, again, it's not surprising that the French would demand that everything has to take place through the UN Security Council, where they have a veto, because if it doesn't, then France is really left standing on the sideline, and it does hurt their pride.
Let's go next to Doug, who's with us from Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting you were talking about this post-empire concept, because my question has to do with the separation, the difference between England and the rest of Europe supporting the war, which may be due either to this post-empire wish to still be an empire, or the fact that in the last 100 years it was England and the United States that went about divvying up the oil-rich countries in the Middle East, rather than primarily Germany and the rest of Europe. and whether that direction has to do with England's support of Bush and the war in Iraq.
Well, I think there's no question that for people, for Britons, there is a certain feeling that they should play a big role on the world stage also. And they really do have, by European standards, a sizable military capability. But I think it's important to remember, and I've been in London recently, and I've had lots of talks with the British intellectuals and foreign policy experts, and Tony Blair is way out in front of his public. The polls in Britain are just about as bad against American approach to Iraq as they are on the continent, and most intellectuals that I talk to and all of Tony Blair's friends think that he's doing something terrible by supporting Bush.
Way out in front may be the wrong direction.
Or behind, depending on
behind, right. Whatever. He's not where his public is, put it that way.
Yeah, okay, I'll agree with that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Doesn't that suggest that an awful lot rests on how this comes out?
Well, that is exactly right. And Tony Blair has, I think, quite courageously, that's my personal opinion, quite courageously put, in a way, his whole very successful prime ministership on the line in supporting the Americans on this issue. I think that if things go reasonably well in Iraq, everything is not going to be perfect, and you won't have a golden democracy shining in Baghdad in 2 months from now. But if things go reasonably well, I think there's a fair chance that Blair and Aznar and Berlusconi and the others who have sided with the Americans may wind up looking pretty good. Blair is obviously doing this for his own reasons of conviction and because of the place that he wants Britain to have in the world. But Blair is a very, very savvy politician, and I can't help but think that he thinks that in the long run, this may be the smart political move as well as the right move.
Similarly, Gerhard Schroeder seems to be betting on the other horse.
Well, and it's an interesting question to see whether he will succeed. Gerhard Schroeder is where his people are. He's not in front or behind or anything else. He speaks for the common German man and woman in the street in his opposition to this war. At the same time, it's clear that Schroeder is also trying to divert, as best he can, some of the anxiety and angst that exists in Germany today because of the failing economy, and especially in former East Germany, and trying to sort of point their attention outwards and direct their anger at Bush and the Americans rather than at Schroeder himself. And that may not be working because he just recently suffered a very bad electoral defeat in Lower Saxony, and his party is holding on to power now very tenuously, and he personally is quite unpopular. So I don't know if at the end of the day Blair may emerge from this whole thing much stronger than Schroeder.
Not only Lower Saxony, but Hesse as well.
Right.
Our guest is Robert Kagan. His book is Of Power, Of Paradise and Power, America and Europe in the New World Order. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's go to Michael, who's on the line with us from Stavanger in Norway.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I think one of the reasons that Europeans are very negative to the war in Iraq is a mere skepticism over the use of military power. Is this a question that can be solved with sending in the troops? I really don't see how. So, you can talk about that America is always making the U.S. step up to the plate and do the job and whatever, but this is a job I really don't think the Europeans want the U.S. to do.
Well, that's absolutely right, and you've expressed a classically European opinion, and I think, for me, what's interesting is not, I think that your point is a debatable point. It may be true, it may not be true. What I find interesting, just from an analytical point of view, is why that opinion is so universally held in Europe, as opposed to the United States, where there's an actual debate.
I think one reason is that the way the debate is termed in America is good versus evil, which is sort of got an uncomfortable religious connotation to it. And I just don't think that Europeans think that merely getting rid of one leader in Iraq is going to make the situation all that much better for the people.
No, I know that that is true, that Europeans don't think that. I also think, by the way, that Europeans couldn't care less what happens in Iraq, because until the United States raised this issue to the fore, no Europeans were discussing what to do about Iraq at all.
Well, a lot of Europeans were in favor, as indeed I am, of not having the sanctions against Iraq.
No, I know that that's
very, very counterproductive.
No, I know that that's true, but I just find interesting the fact that there was no great drive in Europe to solve the Iraq problem one way or another. I mean, there was people who held various opinions, but it was a dead issue in Europe until the United States raised it, which is what makes me sometimes suspicious that, you know, it's only when the United States says that we ought to do something that all of a sudden the Europeans have 15 different better ways to solve the problem, which may in fact be legitimate. But what were they doing the past 10 years when the United States was not threatening to invade? They weren't doing anything in any case. So.
Well, that's true enough. But now let's go back to the Gulf War. When Iraq invaded Kuwait, there were an awful lot of countries in Europe that took part in that military operation because it was obvious. Here's this little country getting smothered by this big country. So even little Norway, where I live, sent some troops down to help that situation a bit. But nothing really has happened all that much in Iraq since then. It's America that's making this problem. I mean, Saddam Hussein is a bad leader, but I feel that the solution is actually to get rid of the sanctions against Iraq, to have more trade, more cultural exchange with the country. And so that's, you know, you're framing the question in a very strange way. If you assume that a military action against Saddam Hussein is correct, then you can wonder why Europe's not doing its part to help. But if you don't think it's the thing to do, you'd have to conclude that maybe the Europeans are right.
Well, let me ask this almost the opposite way. This is from an American emailer, Dan Gold. I think the old adage is particularly applicable to this discussion. He writes, the U.S. tends to try to solve problems while Europe tends to try to live with problems.
Yes, I agree. I think that's wonderful. But by living with problems, you can also help them to get a little bit better day by day or year by year at any rate. I really don't think that simply getting rid of Saddam Hussein is going to make the situation any better for people in Iraq.
Well, we'll find out, and we'll see who's right.
I don't think we will, but let's see.
I mean, right now it's a theoretical question, but at some point we'll figure out who was right in this argument.
I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
We're talking with Robert Kagan, the author of Paradise and Power, America and Europe in the New World Order. He's also director of the U.S. Leadership Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's speaking with us today from our bureau in New York. You're invited to join our discussion. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls about the rift, the growing rift in the Atlantic Alliance. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest this hour is Robert Kagan, who's been writing about the relationship between the United States and Europe in a new book called Of Power and Paradise, America and Europe in the New World Order. To get in on the conversation, give us a phone call at 800-989-8255 or send us email totn@npr.org. And Robert Kagan, I want to skip ahead towards the end of your book. In a section you call Adjusting to Hegemony, you write, America did not change on September the 11th. It only became more itself. Nor should there be any mystery about the course America is on and has been on, not only over the past year or over the past decade, but for the better part of the past six decades, and one might even say for the better part of the past four centuries. And I'm going to skip a little bit here. The myth of America's isolationist tradition is remarkably resilient, but it's a myth. Expansion of territory and influence has been the inescapable reality of American history, and it has not been an unconscious expansion. And I want you to talk a little bit. You go on to talk about, I think, what most historians describe as the idea of American exceptionalism, that this is the last best hope of the people of the earth.
Well, I think it is. Americans are a little bit... I would say, unaware of their own history to some extent. And every time we are about to embark on something like perhaps this military action against Iraq, there are many Americans who say, well, this is not what America does. We don't engage in these kinds of activities. We don't expand our strategic purview to places like the Middle East. And I just find that odd if you do go back and look at the entire sweep of American history since before we had even been born as a nation. We really have been expanding our territory and influence for 400 years. We have fought many wars over the course of the past century. Even in the last 13 years alone, we have fought, deployed troops and fought six relatively reasonable-sized wars. And so Americans shouldn't be so surprised. And it's true that America does believe, and Americans have traditionally believed, that the expansion of American power and influence is good not only for the United States, but also in general for the world. And I suppose if there is an exceptionalism in American foreign policy, it's that. It's the belief that America is a fundamentally benevolent power, that where we spread our influence, it is generally on behalf of democratic principles and on behalf of a capitalism that serves everybody fairly well. And so we feel genuinely that the use of our power is something that is justified in broader moral terms, not just in terms of our narrow interests.
Our next caller is Marty, who's on the line with us from Buffalo, Wyoming.
Hello there.
Hi.
You're going to have to forgive me because I'm a little bit politically naive, I'm a mother that stays at home, but I've been very impassioned listening to you speak about this issue. I feel like it worries me that our country is starting to become that which we strove to separate ourselves from, and that is, we keep hearing this word power come up over and over again. When our country was formed, we were under extreme influence of power, and we didn't want to be. We wanted to make our own choices, and yet I feel like the United States imposes our opinions and our belief and our power on others throughout the world, and it seems so backwards as to what we wanted when we became a country. And having lived in Europe myself 10 years ago, I feel like that's some of what the Europeans resent about Americans, is this egotistical feeling that we know what's right for the world, and they've gone through that, having experienced many different powers, being in power in Europe. I think Europeans are still so close to that and are somewhat resentful at Americans feeling like the American way is the right way. And I love America, but I think as Americans, we should be grasping onto the fact that there isn't a right way. This world is full of different ways, and so it concerns me. That might be a little outside of the subject, but I think that...
Oh, I think it's right on the subject, Marty.
I do, too, and it's a very articulate statement of a very strongly held point of view in America, and it's a very legitimate point. I actually disagree that you know, it was ever the case in American history when Americans didn't believe in using power for a variety of reasons. After all, it was our young country that used its power to expand across a continent and wiped out a lot of Indian tribes along the way, and drove the Spaniards off the continent, and drove the French off the continent, and drove the British off the continent. We were a very, very aggressive power in our youth. And have remained so in many respects. But I would say if you look then, skip ahead to the 20th century, look, all powers in the United States is no exception, tend to think that they're right and tend to use their power the way to serve their own purposes and have a certain egotism to them. But what the United States did twice in the 20th century, which was to send troops to Europe to save Europeans from brutal tyranny and aggression, was really quite remarkable, and I don't think that either Americans or Europeans should lose sight of that. It was a very unselfish, it was certainly in our interest, but there was also a tremendously unselfish quality to the way Americans behaved in the last century. And I'll just finish with this, and then I want, you know, obviously you should respond. But in my view, We will be doing the world an enormous favor again if we rid them, if we rid the world of one of the most awful, brutal aggressors who's used weapons of mass destruction against his own people and against his neighbors, who has invaded countries on his borders twice in the last 2 decades, and will do so again, in my opinion. I think that that will be in the tradition of America acting on behalf of global security.
But I feel like if we look at the past wars and when we did intervene, it feels to me in my heart that the motives have been a little bit different. When we did intervene, let's say in the Second World War, that motive was somewhat out of our own freedoms being, I'm not going to be able to think of a good word here, but have we asked the world? I feel like this is where the problem is. There is some debate in the world as to if they want. We feel like we're going out to rid the world of these powers. Does the world want us to come and rid the world of these powers? It feels like sometimes we're stepping in and deciding we're going to do this because we're the most powerful nation, and everyone else is just going to have to go along with it, whether they want it or not. And that might be naive, but the motives feel different to me. They feel different. It feels more like we're powerful, we're going to do this, versus our freedoms were being infringed upon, we need to step in now.
Marty, does it feel to you like the United States is a bully?
Oh, yes. And I feel terrible saying such a thing as that. I love our country and I love the freedom that I have here, but yes, I feel like our country is a bully. I do feel that way, yes. Has anyone stepped out and said that on the radio?
Oh, I'm sure they have.
Not as well as you have.
It needs to be said. And I think that Europeans think we're bullies.
Robert Kagan, we just have a couple of minutes left. I think this is exactly on the point of your book, and wondered if you wanted to respond.
Well, I do think that the caller has cut to the heart of the debate, and it's a worthwhile debate, and it's one of the reasons why I believe that the Bush administration, although it wasn't necessarily its first instinct, did go to the UN Security Council for a resolution on this war, and will probably go to the UN Security Council for a second resolution to get an authorization for this war, and is now going to be working fairly hard. Secretary of State Powell will be before the UN Security Council making the case or for why this is necessary to do, and I think that the administration does care that it's to try to persuade others that we're right. But it is true, and this is the great conundrum for the United States, that because we have enough power to do this, we are willing and able to do this, and we see the legitimacy of doing it. And because Europeans are weak, I would say, frankly, they're afraid of what's going to happen, and so they're reluctant to do it. Now, if it's a bad idea, then it's a bad idea and we shouldn't do it. But if it's a good idea, and if getting rid of Saddam Hussein is a positive good, then I would say it's a mistake for the United States to look to the weakest and most timid members of the international community, like Germany is right now, for guidance and approval on whether this needs to be done. One of the prices of great power, and I would say one of the prices of world leadership, is the willingness to lead, which means sometimes to lead when not everybody else is going to follow us.
Marty, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but you really can't call yourself naive anymore.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate the phone call.
Bye-bye now.
Robert Kagan, thanks so much for the time.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Robert Kagan has been writing about the relationship between the United States and Europe in a new book called Of Power and Paradise, America and Europe in the New World. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.